Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the program, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this program is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's program, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Marian. I too would like to welcome everyone today to the Cancer Care Connect program for caregivers of women living with metastatic breast cancer. And that includes a lot of different people, from spouses to partners to parents, daughters, sons, sisters, brothers, families, and friends. We welcome you all to today's program for caregivers, especially designed for you. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and 25 other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you. And we have over 525 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities and from suburban and from rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from the UK. So you really come from all over the world, and we're delighted to have you with us. We also know that as caregivers, you are incredibly busy all the time. So we're just delighted that you could spend this time with us, time just for you. I'd like to turn your attention to the materials that you see from Cancer Care. And those materials include an outline that our speakers have prepared. There also is information about all the different partnering organizations, and there's information about all upcoming programs that Cancer Care is offering and upcoming telephone workshops. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and please complete that evaluation form. You know, your feedback is so important to us. You know, who but each of you can best tell us what to offer in a program, what topics we should cover. And indeed, the topic for caregivers was a topic that many of you have asked us to do, and so now we're finally able to do it, and I really want to thank you for making those recommendations and continuing to tell us what you'd like us to do. Also, today's program is supported by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I really want to thank them for supporting this particular program. And I want to also let you know that this program will also, we're going to have the live program today, this program that you're all listening to, and also you will in a couple of months receive what we call a Cancer Care Connect booklet, especially designed for caregivers, with some of the content that was covered on today's program as well. Now, we have wonderful speakers on today's program, and I'm going to start with our first speaker, Dr. Guadalupe Palos. Dr. Palos is actually her own healthcare team. Actually, she represents many different disciplines. She is also assistant professor at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, Division of Internal Medicine, Department of Symptom Research. And Dr. Palos has spoken on many of our programs involving caregiving. And she is going to talk about the challenges and rewards of caregiving and the role of the caregiver. And I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Palos.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you for this very, very important discussion on caregivers of women living with metastatic breast cancer. Many of you participating on this call understand what this diagnosis means, not only to the patient, but also to the patient's family, their loved ones, their friends. They know that living with metastatic cancer is a journey that involves the patient and all their families, of course, and their caregivers. The path of this journey leads to multiple complex and yet at times rewarding challenges for the patient and for their caregivers. Their caregivers. Now, what is that with the caregivers? We hear that phrase over and over and over again, but there's still an aura of mystery or unknown linked to this word. Questions arise as to what is a caregiver, who is a caregiver, what does a caregiver do, and what are the effects or consequences of being a caregiver. Now, in the next 10 minutes or so, I plan to address these questions by briefly discussing the role of the caregiver, how it may change once their loved one is diagnosed with metastatic cancer. I will talk about some of the actual activities or things that caregivers often do. And then briefly, I will discuss the types of physical and emotional effects that a caregiver experiences as they face new challenges in their roles. One of the first questions may be, who or what is a caregiver? If I were to ask you to close your eyes for a moment and picture a caregiver, who would come to your mind? Would it be a healthcare professional, that is, someone who cared for you while you were ill? with a doctor, a nurse, a nurse assistant? Or would that word caregiver bring to mind your husband, partner, son, or daughter, your parent, a close friend, or yourself? Are you the one that you're picturing as you hear the term caregiver? So a question that often arises is, what is a caregiver? There's a great deal of confusion over this term. Some people think it refers to a healthcare professional who provides some type of technical healthcare to a patient. Yet others, and we see this quite a bit now with our organizations and in the literature on caregiver, believe that it refers to a family member or a friend who provides help or support to a loved one diagnosed with cancer or any other type of chronic disease for that matter. More recently, the term family or informal caregiver, family caregiver, informal caregiver, has been used to refer to the person who provides some type of help to a loved one. Interestingly, some of these definitions even include a time frame for being designated as a caregiver. Some definitions say it's someone who spends 4 hours or more per week providing that type of care. Now, those of you who are caregivers might be saying to yourselves, oh, I'm too busy to keep track of the time I spend doing. Caregiving, if I let it be, could be a 24/7 experience. So I'd like to propose a simple definition. A caregiver is any person who helps a loved one during their illness. Although this definition may be simple, being a caregiver for someone diagnosed with cancer, especially a woman living with metastatic breast cancer, is a complex, multidimensional, exhausting, and at times extremely rewarding experience. In short, the role of a caregiver will vary from day to day and at times from hour to hour. Now, many of you listening to this teleconference understand what I'm saying. If I were to ask you, what is your role as a caregiver, your responses would vary. For example, some of you would say, oh, I keep track of all the medicines she's taking. Others would say, well, I drive her to all the appointments to the clinic. And some would say, well, I cook. I help with the children. I walk the doggies. And some would say, I just spend time with her, visiting, talking, listening, or even praying. There's no doubt that being a caregiver can be both challenging and sometimes rewarding. For instance, research has shown that caregivers may experience a condition called caregiver burden. That is, their physical and mental health may be affected when caring for someone diagnosed with a chronic disease. This caregiver burden may change over the course of the disease. So there are peaks and valleys of caregiver activities, and you might recall some of that. At the beginning, when your loved one was first diagnosed, you know there was a flurry of activities and lots of new information and lots of different things that you had to do. And then, you know, things became more under control. They stabilized a bit. And you weren't in that role quite as much. It wasn't quite as hectic as it used to be. And now maybe you're finding yourself at a time where it's very similar to that initial diagnosis. Even though you've dealt with the disease over the period of time, now with the metastatic condition being involved, it involves new roles for you again or old roles being revisited again. So you understand what those peaks and valleys are of your caregiver activities. So as the roles of the caregiver changes, so do their responsibilities. And what happens is that these changes may affect the caregiver's health. They may experience greater fatigue. They're tired all the time, they say. And it's a different kind of tired from the tiredness or fatigue that your loved one says they have. There's sleep disturbances, such as not enough sleep. I had one woman tell me one time, you know, I just feel like I can't shut my mind off. I'm always just thinking, thinking, thinking. Or they may experience great sadness or distress. On the other hand, a few studies, though, have shown that caregivers discovered positive aspects of being a caregiver. Some say they found new strengths or talents they weren't aware of before. Others report that being able to spend more time with their loved one led to a closer relationship that they really cherished as they progressed through the journey of cancer. So by now it may be apparent that there are still many unknowns surrounding the area of caregiver research or of caregiver and caregiving. There is no agreement on the definition of a caregiver, who or what the caregiver is, what they do, what the effects are on their health, and that is why it is so critical for you as caregivers to talk to your loved one's healthcare team about your challenges and experiences. Those moments that you go in and accompany your loved one at those appointments, put a little bit of information before the healthcare team and let them know, you know, I've been doing this. and I have found it stressful. If you can start with them, then they'll be able to say, well, you know, there are some places you can go. There's some people you need to talk to. That's also why it's so important to educate yourselves, just as you're doing at this moment. And in your packet, you receive just lots of different information and places that you can go to, websites you can go to for more education. There is an area, though, where there is universal agreement, and that is caregivers need to keep in mind that being a caregiver may often lead to feeling of sadness or distress and at times even depression. If you or someone you know is experiencing these types of feelings, it's critical to tell someone. Speak to your own healthcare provider, your spiritual leader, even your family. Because remember, by taking care of yourself and maintaining a healthy balance in your life, you can be a better caregiver. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about some of the things that you can do as a caregiver because Patricia is going to share some important ways to do that, and she's also going to talk about some of the resources that are available to you. So in closing, I'd like to remind you that it's important for you as a caregiver to take time for yourself. Don't feel guilty about it. Don't feel that you have to do all. Try to keep a sense of humor with what's going on in your life. I mean, sometimes it may be very difficult, but even if you pick up the Sunday paper and read the funnies, just find something to balance that. And again, explore your own spiritual being. That might help with you with some of the things that you're going through at this time. So this concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Palos, for, as always, just sending wonderful context, describing really what caregivers often do. And many of you know those things that you do and some of the challenges that you face and also some of the rewards and some of the things that you do that make a difference. I now would like to introduce our next speaker, Patricia Spicer. Pat is an oncology social worker. She's a colleague, breast cancer program coordinator here at Cancer Care. And Pat is going to talk about talking with your loved one, determining when you need help, and tips for caregiver self-care. Pat?
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and it's a pleasure to be on this wonderful conference because I think caregivers are so often neglected for all the wonderful things that they do. When someone is diagnosed with cancer, it's a little bit like throwing a stone in the water. The ripples extend out through the family and through the roles that are present in the family, and caregiving is one of those major roles. Your role as a caregiver is a complex one, and you may observe your loved one going through difficult changes, both physical, emotional, social, and spiritual, and that is stressful and difficult for you to deal with as well. Being a caregiver can become a full-time job, and focusing on your own needs is just as important as that job. And I'd like to talk to you today about some things that might be helpful to help you cope with the challenges of caring for your loved one as well as for yourself. But I think it's important at the beginning that we focus on what it means to be, for a few minutes at least, a metastatic breast cancer patient. If you close your eyes and think about what most people think about when they envision a person with metastatic breast cancer, it can be someone who is very ill. But today, because of many of the treatments that are available, women even with stage 4 metastatic disease have a quality of life that is different. And as a caregiver, sometimes we become over-concerned with what that person wants to do for themselves or allowing them to do things that they think would be satisfactory for them, but you were concerned that it could be harmful. So it's important to think about who this person is, how strong they are, and allowing them the dignity of having the determination about what activities they would like to be part of and what role they would like to continue to have in the family. It's important to let the ill person talk about what they're feeling, and communication is one of the things that we really want to focus on today. Not only them talking to you, but you talking to them so that they are aware of some of the things that you are experiencing, just as you need to hear what's going on for them. You may need to hear their fears about separation from family or about what it's like to have unfinished tasks, and some of these feelings will be hard to listen to, but your presence and your courage will help to helping to listen can prevent their feelings of isolation or of loneliness. You don't have to solve the problem. You just have to listen, and being a good listener is probably one of the best skills that you can bring to your role as a caregiver. The other thing you need to look at is becoming informed. If you're going to be a caregiver, use your healthcare team for support. Become familiar with the doctor or nurse, of course, with your patient's permission, and talk to them about what you see or what your concerns are for the person who is ill. It's a good idea to help the person who is ill or yourself create a list of questions so that when you go to the doctor, and time is always precious, you can then take the time to develop the answers that you need for yourself and for your patient. It's also good to look at who else is on that healthcare team. The oncology social workers, the oncology nurses are very often excellent sorts of support and of information. You also want to look at seeking support for yourself. You need time to yourself. You need time to just simply get away from what's going on within your family or with the patient. And it's not selfish. It's self-nurturing to take time to go to a Tai Chi class or for some meditation or just to go out for a walk. Had a client a few years ago whose wife was very ill with metastatic breast cancer. And at times, patients can be difficult. They can be cross, and they can be regressed, and they can be demanding. And he walked into her room, and she was at a particularly low point, and he finally said, "Susan, I'm going to take the dog for a walk." And she looked at him and said, "Alan, we don't have a dog." And he said, "We do now. I'm taking it for a walk." And that became their kind of catchphrase. Whenever it became too overwhelming, Alan would kind of just say, "Okay, Susan, I'm getting up and taking a dog for a walk now." That simple walk around the block, just out in the fresh air and maybe waving to a neighbor, made all the difference in the world, and he was able to come back and go on with his role. Also, it's all right to need help. It's not that you are a failure or that you are not doing a good job, but by all means, don't forget that when people offer to help, accept it. Let people go to do the supermarket shopping or pick up the kids at soccer practice or decide which one of your friends and families might be able to share some of the role with you, and they will really feel good about what they're doing. Look into community agencies, religious institutions, or even volunteer programs within the neighborhood that can offer you a little bit of care so that you can get away for a period of time as well. Plan a few moments every day that belong to you, even if it's a quiet cup of coffee, a walk around the yard, but something that belongs to you, a couple of minutes on the computer, whatever brings you some sense of relief. And remember that people who are ill very often can be difficult, and as much as you love them, they can be very demanding. They can ask more of you than you can give it at every moment in time. So don't be afraid to set some boundaries, to say, "No, we can't do this right now," or "I've had a bad day too." It's all right to be angry. There are times when the whole situation is going to make you feel angry and confused. And those feelings may seem negative, but they're perfectly normal, and most people experience them at some time or place. Attend to your own needs is really important, and understand also that you can create a peaceful atmosphere for you and for the person you're caring for. You don't have to talk all the time, but soft music helps, sometimes light scents like from a potpourri, and just a calm, quiet atmosphere so you can just sit together and be involved with just one another. Keep in mind, though, that talking is important, and as I said before, listening to what that person needs to say is all right. You don't have to answer. You don't have to have answers. You just have to be a good listener. And by all means, retain physical contact. People who are sick very often tell us how people stop touching them. So holding their hands or offering them a hug or kissing them goodbye before you leave for work or whatever you're doing is a very important way of making that person still feel as though they belong in the family and a part of the family. The other thing you need to do is think about getting support for yourself. And at Cancer Care, we offer support groups for caregivers as well as for the patient. And to access a support group, you can contact us online at www.cancercare.org or by calling 1-800-813-4673, and you will be referred to an appropriate social worker so that you can talk to someone about your cares and concerns. And lastly, but not least, remember to maintain a sense of humor, and sometimes even black humor helps. But the ability to laugh and to share that laughter with the person who you're caring for is important. The other thing I'd just like to close with is that sometimes, particularly the spouses of women with breast cancer, one of the things that they say most often is, I feel so helpless. I'm the man. I'm supposed to take care of my wife, and I can't protect her. You are taking care of her. You don't have to solve the problem. You just have to be there to listen and to continue to love her. At Cancer Care, we want to offer you help and hope. Keep remembering to call us whenever you need that help. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Pat, really, for just a wonderful, really wonderful presentation and particularly reminding everybody that you really don't have to have a dog to take a walk. And that's really just words of wisdom as we all forget about those things. So thanks for helping us give us some creative and practical tips that could be very helpful to everybody to take that break that is so much needed often by caregivers. Our next speaker is Dr. Linda Vedat. Dr. Vedat is Medical Director, Breast Cancer Research Program, Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And since many of you as caregivers often accompany the people that you love, to the women that you love, to their medical appointments, I'm going to ask Dr. Vedat to really address some of the communication issues that she often sees in working with caregivers, and also to provide some overview briefly of some of the treatments that are available currently for the treatment of metastatic breast cancer. So I'm going to call upon Dr. Vedat, who actually is a frequent presenter on our cancer care programs, also a member of the Cancer Care Board. Dr. Vedat?
Thank you, Carolyn, and welcome, everyone. It's great that you're on the call in order to find ways to help yourselves and to help your caregivers. So today what I'd like to talk about is I'd like to give you an overview of metastatic breast cancer, which is also known as stage 4 breast cancer. I wanted to go through some of the things that I see in terms of understanding the whole process, because I do this quite frequently. I've been able to sort of, I hope, develop some informational strategies that really help people understand what's going on, both the patient as well as the caregiver, because I think if you understand what's going on, then you're going to be less anxious and less questioning on a certain level and actually be less scared. So let's start with the definition. So there are two terms which mean the same thing, and that is that stage 4 breast cancer is the same thing as metastatic breast cancer. And all that means is that breast cancer has spread somewhere outside the lymph nodes in the neck. So different places that breast cancer might like to spread to are places such as bone, lung, liver, nodes, and less likely brain, but sometimes that happens. And a frequent question I receive from my patients is, well, they say, well, doc, if it spread to my lung, does that mean I have lung cancer? And the answer is no. If we were actually to put a needle and take out a little bit of the cells that we see that are forming a tumor and look at them under the microscope, they actually look like breast cancer cells. So that's a myth I would like to dispel. So this is a breast cancer cell that has spread to other parts of the body. And most people who have breast cancer that has spread usually feel perfectly fine. And it's not unusual for a patient to be sitting in my office and saying, well, doc, what do you mean my breast cancer has spread? I actually feel perfectly fine. So I would like to take some of the fear out of that, is that most people who have breast cancer that spread actually do feel perfectly fine. Sometimes, though, patients do have symptoms, and usually the symptoms are related to the sites where it is spread. So for example, if a patient has a bone metastasis, they may have some discomfort in an area that bone metastasis is. So they might feel, if it's in the rib, they might feel a little bit discomfort on their rib. If they have a metastasis in their neck from a lymph node, they may feel a little fullness in that particular area. But I would say the vast majority of patients really don't have any symptoms from where their metastasis is spread to. So usually, if we suspect that breast cancer has spread, there are different ways that we try to assess exactly where it's spread, just because it's a good idea to sort of know the situation for ultimately deciding what kind of treatment is best. So usually, thinking about from a practical point of view, what we'll do is that we will usually get scans. And sometimes we'll get CT scans of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, or a bone scan. And the CT scan of the chest will look at the lungs as well as the lymph nodes in the chest. The CT scan of the abdomen will assess the liver and the lymph nodes in the back of the stomach. And the pelvis will also look at lymph nodes as well as the ovaries. We also usually do a bone scan, and a bone scan will assess as to whether there are any metastases in the bone. Now, while these tests are very good, sometimes, depending on the situation, we'll order something called a PET CT scan. And this test is a little bit different from CAT scans in that it's just not looking for little lumps of cancer. What it's looking for is it's looking for what we call metabolically active areas. Now, one of the things that we know is that breast cancer, or any cancer for that matter, because any cancer tends to divide quickly, that means it needs more glucose. Glucose is sugar, and glucose is energy for these tumors. So what happens with the PET CT scan is that we inject patients with radioactive glucose and then look to see if there are any areas that are particularly hot spots. And sometimes we will, if there is an area which is a hot spot, that might make us suspicious that it's a site of a cancer metastasis. I can't tell you that one way to scan a patient is better than the other, and you'll need to discuss this with your healthcare provider and make sure you have open lines of communication in order to try to ascertain what is the best approach. And this can change at all times. So frequently I will have patients who will ask me if whether or not they should get a PET CT scan because they heard that's a better test. I'm not so sure it's a better test. So once we have an idea or we have a suspicion that a cancer has spread, when possible, we usually like to get a piece of that tissue to look under the microscope in order to see if indeed it is breast cancer. We usually do that several ways, and it all depends on where this on where the metastasis is. So, for example, if there is a what we call a chest wall metastasis or a little nodule on the chest wall, then usually the surgeon can just take a fine needle biopsy of that area and look at it under the microscope. Sometimes if there's an area in the lung or the liver which is abnormal, what we will do is that we will do what we call a CT-guided biopsy in order to get a piece of tissue to look under the microscope. It's usually important to do this because one of the things we've learned through the years is that breast cancer can change how it grows. And specifically what I mean is that sometimes if a tumor used estrogen and progesterone to grow, it's always a possibility that the metastasis doesn't use it. Also, if a tumor used another growth pathway called HER2-new, sometimes the metastasis will use it or not use it. So it's important to get all of this information so that we know how best to treat you. So once we've confirmed that there is a diagnosis of stage 4 breast cancer, then we start to think, what's the best way to treat the patient? And what's always going on in an oncologist's head, and I'm sure everyone's head, is how can we manage efficacy and toxicity in terms of the balancing act? Because certainly if a patient has no symptoms from their cancer and they feel perfectly fine, which most do, you don't want to make them feel lousy from the side effects of their treatment. So you're always trying to do this mental balancing act. Certainly if someone is very symptomatic from their cancer and that maybe they have some pain or they can't breathe or there's something else going on, well, then you're going to be more worried about shrinking the cancer down with perhaps stronger therapy and not worrying so much about the side effects, at least in the short term. So when someone is initially diagnosed with a stage 4 cancer, stage 4 breast cancer, things that we like to make sure are, does the tumor use estrogen and progesterone to grow, or is it HER2 positive? Then what we start to do is that we start to figure out, well, is this patient a candidate for a hormone treatment? We usually like to use hormone treatments, or really anti-hormone treatments, because if a tumor likes to use estrogen to grow, then by getting rid of estrogen, we'll make the tumor shrink. And there are many hormone treatments that we can use. Usually, no matter what treatment we use, the first treatment that we will give will more often than not shrink the tumor, and it will stay shrunk anywhere from months to years. It's hard to predict. But then the tumor starts to develop resistance, starts to grow. So what we usually do is we stop whatever that treatment is, and we put them on another treatment. And that second treatment, more often than not, shrinks the tumor, keeps it from growing. But then the tumor develops resistance, starts to grow, so we stop what we're giving, we put them on something else. And the good thing in breast cancer, we have lots and lots and lots of different things that we can do. We have a really long list. So as I had mentioned before, hormonal treatment is usually our first line, and when we can use it, just because from a side effect point of view, it tends to have less side effects than, say, chemotherapy. There are many different kinds of hormone therapies that we can use, and some familiar names are tamoxifen. There's another medicine called anastrozole or arimidex, another hormone called letrozole or exemestane. In addition, there's another medicine called Faslodex. I'm just mentioning these names so that you could hear some of the hormones that we use to treat breast cancer when it's spread. And it's not unusual. I have many patients in my practice who've had breast cancer that have spread that have been on hormonal therapy for more than 5 or 6 years and still going strong on it. The second category of standard treatments is basically radiation therapy. And radiation therapy is something that we use when there is a particular problem in a particular area. Because while hormone therapy treats the whole body, and as does chemotherapy, radiation therapy only treats a particular area that is problematic. So if our patient has some back pain or some rib pain, what we might do is give a spot of radiation for a couple of weeks, and that usually takes care of the problem. The third category of treatment is chemotherapy. And there are lots of different kinds of chemotherapy that we use when breast cancer has spread. Luckily, many of them don't cause hair loss. Many of them don't cause nausea or vomiting. And actually, there are some that are pills. Just to throw out some names, there are names of some drugs called capecitabine or Xeloda, navalbine, which is also known as vinorelbine. There's Taxol and Taxotere. There are drugs such as Doxol, as well as many, 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 many other drugs. And a couple of weeks ago, a brand new drug was approved called ixabepilone. And because it's such a long name, I'm glad that the trade name is shorter and it's called Exempra. So there's a lot of new stuff coming out all the time. The fourth category of drugs which we use to treat breast cancer that are spread is called biologics. And in that category, there are basically three drugs right now with a lot of drugs coming down the pike in development. So the first one that was approved that's a biologic, and by the way, a biologic is a genetically engineered molecule, is Herceptin, also known as trastuzumab. And this is why it's important to test the tumors to see if they use the HER2-new growth pathway, because HER2-new is sort of a growth accelerator on tumor cells. But luckily, we have drugs that can neutralize it, so that's why it's important to know that. So the first drug is Herceptin or trastuzumab, and the new kid on the block is lapatinib or Tykerb. That's a pill, but that also targets HER2-new in a little bit of a different way. There's a third biologic that we use in breast cancer, and it's called Avastin or bevacizumab, and it seems to be very good for some patients, not, of course not good for others. I'm sure it's going to have a very prominent role in breast cancer moving forward, but right now we're trying to figure it all out. So as you can see, there are lots of different treatments which can be used. Now, clinical trials are a really important part of how we move breast cancer treatment forward. And luckily, it's lucky for us and for patients that there are a lot of really good drugs in clinical development right now. So this is where it's really key to keep open lines of communication with your healthcare provider about drugs which look particularly good. And the good thing about clinical trials is that you can sort of go between clinical trials and standard therapy depending on the situation at hand. A frequent misconception I see among my patients is that they think, oh my gosh, I'm doing a clinical trial. That must mean that I'm a goner and there's nothing else for me to do. And that couldn't be further from the truth. What we've seen through the years is that probably, you know, these clinical trials have really improved the life of women and as well as the longevity of women who have metastatic breast cancer. So I would really encourage you to speak to your doctor. In addition, on the National Cancer Institute website, they usually have geared towards patients clinical trials for breast cancer that spread, and I would encourage you to look at that. This new drug, which was just approved, called ixabepilone, we were very involved in the development, as well as many other places. But it's sort of nice to know that our patients have been having access to that drug for about 7 years, and it just got FDA approved. We're working with another drug now called E7389, and many other places are too, and that looks like a pretty good drug for breast cancer also, as well as there are other drugs out there which also look very good. So I think it's a really good time for new drugs for metastatic breast cancer. And since the trend is to develop drugs which are really focused on how a cancer grows as to sort of the kitchen sink approach, I think the future is really bright. So I think it's very important for all of you to really keep open lines of communication with your healthcare providers about new treatments which may benefit you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Vedat, for an excellent presentation. I want to really thank you for your just really expressing so much about the new treatments and also about the importance of everyone communicating with the healthcare team. Now, I want to thank all of our speakers today really for just being, just wonderful on this call today, just doing a wonderful presentation. And, of course, I want to ask all of you, I want to thank all of you who have been listening as well on the call today. You've really just been terrific as listeners on the call today. And I also want to remind all of you this is a one-hour education program, and in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a program like this. Now, I do want to remind all of you that we do have another program on caregiving next week on November 14th. It's for caregivers coping with a loved one's cancer during the holidays. So I have to say this is the first year that we've had two programs for caregivers, especially highlighting the needs of caregivers within a week of each other. So please do take advantage of the other program as well. Now, again, I just want to sum up. You have lots of resources that you've in your materials that you can access, all those organizations, all those 25 organizations that have partnered with Cancer Care. But I do also want to say a word about the services of Cancer Care. They are free. We have 40 master's-level trained oncology social workers who are here to help you with a variety of issues, from financial and practical concerns to counseling. We also offer a chance to talk with somebody. We also offer support groups, both on the telephone and online support groups. And we also have, of course, the telephone education workshops and many materials and publications that are available for all of you as well. So we do have a host of services, a bit of a menu of services. You can pick and choose those that you would find most helpful to you. But most importantly, as we conclude this program today, we do not want any one of you to feel alone in coping with your loved one's cancer, or some of you are on the call today who are themselves coping with metastatic breast cancer. We don't want any of you to feel that you're alone. We want you to know that you're now part of a community of support, of services from Cancer Care, and that you can access them by calling us at 1-800-813-HOPE or visiting our website at www.cancercare.org. So, again, I want to thank you all for participating today. I look forward to you being on the calls in the future, and I want to thank you all and wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.